If Murray has supported the show, I'd be less sick of podcasts.
Sending out good vibes. Good vibes. Good vibes. Good vibes. Good vibes.
Utter deep breaths of deep gratitude and prayers for guidance and protection. And put on a didgeridoo and shamanic drumming track. Shivers or vibrations and stuff like that.
Stephen Hannum, welcome to Grimerica. Thanks for joining us and congratulations on Machiavelli Nation.
Thank you, Graham. Thanks for having me. I'm super excited to be here.
We're excited to have you too. I mean, this has been great. This has been a great experience getting your book on audio and, Darren and you worked on that mainly, but congratulations, man. It's funny because we have people coming to us with books and stuff like that. And it's like, it's hard to fit in reading and all. But as soon as I started reading it and listening to it, I was just caught with it. And I was like, this seems good. Like it's more, more professional than expected. So, I mean, I got to ask you, how long did it take you? And it seemed to take a lot of deep research too. So, it's kind of fascinating.
Well, it took me about 5 years of actual writing, but it's kind of built out of things that I've been thinking about, apart from a book, just ideas that I have that come into my mind and I think, well, that'd be a really awesome idea. Never follow through with it because the next idea always comes in the very, very next day. And then I just put it on a shelf in the back of my mind, but I thought during COVID, especially when it first started, I thought, I definitely want to put all these ideas into a book and also give people something to think about. It's a world that we live in now that, I'm sure the majority of people are totally confused and baffled and distraught and they have no context for it. But I wanted, part of the reason for the book was to kind of, it's not really like a roadmap, but it's more like, a picture of a world that you live in that you never really knew existed before. It's kind of what the idea behind it was. But yeah, I've been working on it since at least 2020 on and off and full time for the last 2 years, pretty much.
What gave you the idea? How did it all start? Because you're not a writer. You were a teacher, right? So you're not a writer by trade. You just sort of, how did that, fiction especially is like daunting to me to try and get into. There's so much creation and imagination involved and trying to maintain that storyline throughout the whole thing. It just seems like a complicated
character development.
Yeah, it seems wild of an endeavor to undertake.
Yeah, I was a teacher. That was that ended in like 2010. I've been a person that likes to explore different career fields and see different, the world through different eyes. I was in the military. I was in the first Gulf War. I was a teacher. I do, I have hobbies like watch repair and I work on old cars and things like that. And I've always had a creative spark, and writing has been sort of the medium that I like to use. It's mostly just been me writing in journals and that sort of thing. But I finally decided that I wanted to see this through to the end, no matter what it took. And I stuck with it.
Because I got the sense that this is not your first book or this is not like you, I was like, this has got to be a professional writer. Like this has to be, it's really well done. Like the little tiny things, the little descriptions, the little dialogues.
Wow. Thank you.
Honestly, I'm being very honest because I listened to the whole thing. It's on Audible now. It's on our podcast and our podcast feed as well. But it was amazing. Like I pictured it as a screenplay, like as a as like kind of an international intrigue, but with all the topics that we talk about, like the deep topics.
Thank you. No, I've never been a professional writer. If I had all my old journals, it would probably stack up to the ceiling, you know, but it's all ideas and maybe little scenes I might write out or, you know, little comedies I would do. But to my knowledge, I don't think I've ever submitted anything, maybe once or twice a very long time ago. But so much of whether it's art, literature, music, you have to please some gatekeeper or other. And, you know, this book, that's why I had to self-publish. You know, this is not something that Penguin Books is going to likely pick up, right? But all my writing is kind of like that. It's mostly to kind of get it out of my head and onto paper. But that's a very high compliment. I did use a writing service, a editor, not for writing, but just for editing. And believe it or not, this book is 400 pages of book, but I must have pared down at least twice that much, you know, cut out probably an equal number of pages, just editing it down. But
Darren, do you know what I mean by that?
Yeah. Well, I think some of that might just come naturally. I mean, once you can get into that universe, I guess to me the hardest part is like the however you design the characters and get the story arc sort of thing so that you can fit everything into it. But yeah, it's like once you're in there, you do a good job of just being in the world so that you know what to describe and know how to sort of play it out. Like I say, it's written the same way as a couple of my favorite series are. So it's like got that different character point of view where it switches from character to character, like The Expanse or like Game of Thrones, or Abercrombie does that with his Blade Itself series, which really just sort of, that's my favorite style of writing. So it sort of fit in right away. It sort of clicks with that thing where you get to jump from character to character. How many points of view are in it? How many different characters get to share their point of view?
Wow, I couldn't even say. I know that there's the three main characters, which are Bernard, Macy, and Freddie. And then there's four normal humans that are Paco, Topher, Chella, and what's her name? Not Rosalind.
Rose? No?
No, her name is Rhonda. And the rest of the characters are kind of just people for them to play off of. There's one minor character that has his point of view when he's discovering that people aren't falling all over themselves to adore the rich anymore, when it suddenly dawns on him that, oh, we may be in trouble here. You know, that is from his point of view, but mostly it's just from those seven.
Yeah.
But,
so did you make a conscious decision on the style, then that style? Like, did you kind of think, okay, like I'm going to do it that style? And sorry to get all in the weeds here, but I think it'll be fun to kind of pick it apart, but to dig into it a little bit. It might feel like inside baseball to listeners, but listen to the book and you'll kind of understand.
Yeah. I wasn't really shooting for any specific kind of style. Like I said, I pared it down. The process I used was I would think of what I wanted to say, and then I imagined a scene that would take place. You know, this is at the very beginning. That's why I had, you know, 8,000 pages or something I had to throw away. And then once I started getting the book kind of had some form to it, it would then be like, oh yeah, this could be something that Freddie went through, or this could be something Macy had to experience. There's a part in the book, like it's an ode to driving kind of, you know, nowadays modern cars, you get in and you have as much driving experience as you do riding in an Uber, only you're turning the wheel, you know. But driving itself for me is a very visceral and you know, like rare human experience to drive and feel the feelings of the back end sliding out in the back, you know, taking corners and shifting gears and stuff like that. And I wrote this kind of thing and then tied it into the book, you know? So I wouldn't say I had a specific style I was shooting for at the beginning, but when you get into something and stick with it and it's gone through a lot of different iterations, it kind of evolves out of itself, more or less. That's the only way I could describe it. It kind of just worked out that way. And I wanted it to be kind of like refreshing itself all along, to where you're not reading and kind of getting into somebody's life and then getting bored with it.
That's a great way of putting it. I've never considered it like that, but sorry, that's a great way to put it, is that that style is a constant refresh. That's really, it's almost like a scene change in a movie or something like that. I've never heard it explained like that, but that's probably what it is. Because at the end of a chapter, you might be getting just sick of fucking Bernard for a minute. And then boom, okay, well, let's go play in Macy's head for 25 or 30 minutes. And that's a great way of putting it, as a sort of refresh. Do you have to storyboard something like this? Like, do you have a wall in an office with your characters and this arc? So, because that's sort of where I find it the hardest, is how do you, like,
yeah,
for me to start writing this fiction thing and not get lost in three different directions? Like, did you have a start, middle, you know, I'm trying to think of the classic story arc, right? What is it? It's supposed to be, you know, there's all these things that are supposed to happen. Like, did you have something like that?
Well, it's like the hero's journey in a way, right?
Yeah, like you have the hero's journey. Did you have like set points picked out where these things are going to happen and this is how it's going to end, and then you just fill in those blanks?
To a degree, yeah. I had an outline to start with. I shouldn't say to start with. Once it started kind of developing and I could see where it was going and what I wanted to include, then I created an outline, which was, if I could show it to you, which I'd probably take me an hour to find it, but like line through here, cross this out, put an arrow to move that down there. And then I finally said, to hell with this. And I got a big piece of cardboard and, you know, five packs of post-it notes and just set out color-coded post-it notes for, all right, Bernard says this, Macy says that. And then it started looking like a kind of a pattern, you know, like a quilt pattern where you'd have Freddie, Macy, Bernard, you know, secondary character, and then Freddie again. So yeah, to answer your question, at first I didn't, but then I realized I will never get this thing figured out if I don't have some kind of visual aid. And it turned out to be exactly what you said, Darren, a huge piece of cardboard box with post-it notes all over it.
That's, you know, you wonder if that's how some of these guys end up writing 8 books.
Yeah.
Right? Like, you look at The Expanse, you look at, like, a lot of the greats end up being 4, 5, 6 books. It's kind of like that thing you talked about, where if you don't nip it in the bud, this can just keep going and going and going. And you can see where if you had enough success on the first book where you didn't have to worry about making money or, you know, the regular sort of stuff, you could just sort of get lost in that world. What's it like? Is you have to snap out of it? Do you find yourself like in that world sometimes? Because I can get there just reading these books. So what's it like when you're fucking writing it and actively coming up with it?
It's a process of coming out of reality and going into it. It does sometimes take a while to transition from, you know, the world that we live in to the world you're trying to create. But what's fascinating to me is that sometimes these characters, they just seem to develop their own personalities just without even trying. Like that Rosalind I mentioned, she was only supposed to have one line in the whole book, and she ended up having a little journey of her own. And it's funny how that works. I hear people say that. I hear people say things like, oh, it's like being taken over by a spirit. It's been, or these characters have their own voice and things like that. But it really is true. They come. I don't think I was ever taken over by a spirit. Thank God. I don't think I'd like that at all. But they do. They speak to you and you listen to them. And sometimes they complain. I wouldn't say that.
Wow. Well, I'm sure you've heard of the stories, the crazy stories of the tulpas, like the authors that create a character and, you know, it basically brings a person to life or a character to life, you know? You're kind of manifesting that in reality.
Didn't King, like, do a book about that? Isn't that what Misery is like when he gets stuck in that thing with his broken legs? With that crazy broad?
Oh, yeah, Misery.
Misery, yeah. It was like his book come to life, wasn't it?
Did that really happen to him?
I don't know enough. I'm not a big King guy. I think he's a douchebag, but I do remember that movie. Fucking, I don't know if he was always a douchebag. I don't even know if they're just trolling us that this blind guy wrote all these books. And it's just like, you know, you wrote the book, Machiavelli Nation. You know exactly what I'm talking about. We live in this weird fucking half Truman Show existence that in 2026, we don't know what the fuck is real, what is organic, and what was actively made to control perception of the masses.
Exactly. And the book has the foundation that Bernard creates, or that's created for him. And that exists on three levels, where to the normies of the world, it's a foundation doing good, and it's saving women and children from sex trafficking. But to the elites, this is where they get their victims from. They can go there and find children and women to exploit. But the people who run the foundation, for them, they're trying to overturn the massive human trafficking industry that's out there. And I think our world exists on three levels like that. I think there is, you know, a limited hangout for people who are aware of the psyops that go on.
Well, what's the third?
And the third is their own, whoever is doing it, their own secret, you know, motivations. Like I look at John Kerouac, who is the guy that exposed the Pentagon Papers, I think. He exposed something big. I'll think of it in a minute. Maybe the torture program, the CIA torture. He had to go to jail. Do you know this guy, John Kerouac?
Yeah, I've heard of him. I think some of our friends have had him on the show recently, right? He's ex-CIA or something like that?
Ex-CIA, fascinating stories, really interesting. I mean, I wouldn't say a word against him, but who's to say he's not just some psyop that one day they'll need him to say something important, like, oh, no, Israel really is our friend, and then you're supposed to just believe it because it's him. Right. He's been telling us the truth. He went to jail for the truth. He was like, they took all of his money away from him. And there's a line in the book, like, don't believe anything, you know, whatever somebody tells you, that's information. Do some research and find out what's right. But yeah, it's, you can't, you just can't believe. There's nobody that's 100% trustworthy, and who knows where they got their information from. So yeah,
well, That's the thing I loved about your book is, and I don't want to. I'm gonna try not to put spoil. Like I'm gonna try not to do spoilers on here, but we have to tease it a little bit. I mean, you the way you put together the process, you know, of the creation of the fake NGOs, the sort of the almost like the MK, well, there was an MK Ultra aspect to it too, right? And then mm-hmm. the way they would have the long game, you had the players running the long game. Like by the end of it, I'm like, are you, I think you're in one of those societies. I mean, I was like, is Hannum in one of these groups? And I'm reading like the disclosure of how the sausage is made. I mean, it was very realistic. I mean, especially, you know, at the fake trafficking kind of organization, because like the stuff is kind of happening and you're like, oh, maybe that isn't you know, maybe that is a fake trafficking seizure organization that's actually doing it because they're, you know, they're putting their competition out of business in a way, right? Mm. I mean, it's it, so I just really think you did a good job at setting that process up. I mean, even the, even like, I don't want to do spoilers, but the guy at the top, supposedly the guy at the top, you know, his process of watching the media and what's going on and then talking to his younger generation that didn't really want to follow in the footsteps, right? I mean, that whole thing too, we talk about, it's like, you've got a little bit of the the competency crisis or just the non-interest, like the royalty that's kind of up and coming are just not interested in the same thing that, that their forefathers were. So, I mean, I don't know. I don't even, there's not even a real question in there. I'm just running over some of the cool parts in my mind, you know, because these are things we've talked about. Like, are they even ready? Like, there might not even be enough competency to keep running the scam the way it's been going.
Well, before we get too far into it, why don't you give us that elevator pitch? I mean, it really is a good book for the people that are listening to the show, because it's got all the stuff we've been talking about for the last 5 or 6 years tangled up into it. Some people are probably wondering what the fuck we're talking about. So can you just give us like the, you know, without any spoilers, sort of what's the book about, the characters, what they're getting into, all that sort of stuff.
First, I want to say, what's that?
Just sort of why people want to read this book. We're sort of touching on it, but I think just sort of given those characters and what they're up against will sort of get some people. Because, I mean, like I say, it's hard to imagine a better book for our audience.
Thanks. Well, first, I want to say I'm not in any kind of secret society. Get that out of the way. And so the elevator pitch is a tough one, and I've had a couple different versions. But I like to think of it as 1984 for our generation, because so many people are waking up to the reality of the world that you're not going to find in the newspapers and you're not going to find on TV news. And kind of one of the early scenes where Bernard is... he runs into a conspiracy theorist before he's been exposed to any of this stuff. And it just sounds like so much babble to him. It just sounds like so much like wind in his ears. And he feels sorry for the guy to believe all this crazy nonsense. Like, isn't life complicated enough with all the nonsense? But essentially what this book is, it takes a person through the process of first discovering the world that exists beyond the evening news and the Wall Street Journal. And then he's put in a position where he has to try to help overturn the rule of the psychopaths that run this fictional world, very much like the psychopaths that run our own world. And it's a hell of a ride in between. You go through all different, there's so many things that I put in there that I don't think have ever been, would ever appear in a different book, or have, you know, things that make you go, what the hell did I just read? You know, I wanted to throw some stuff in there like that. And, but I just want people to be able to think. I want them to read this book and say, wow, there's a whole reality that's hidden from us. And, you know, it's weird and it's out there, but I just have to keep on keeping on. And there's millions of other people like there out there just like me that are going through the same thing. I don't know. It's not a very good elevator speech, I guess, but I'm working on it.
Yeah, work on the marketing pitch.
Who's your favorite character?
Yeah, I might be able to imitate a professional writer, but not a professional marketer.
Yeah,
it's hard. I was going to guess. I'd say your favorite character is Bernard.
My favorite is Macy, honestly.
Macy?
But I wanted to say before we go on past that, the synopsis you guys wrote was phenomenal. Mm-hmm. I love that. And my wife told me to memorize that, and I haven't been able to do that yet. How would you describe it, Graham? What would be your elevator pitch if you were my professional marketer?
Oh man, I don't know. I mean, I need to, I'm not that quick on my feet, but I need to think about that. But but yeah, I like how it's I like the modern 1984 version, but yeah, I don't know. I'd have to say something like it's kind of it kind of exposes the inner workings of who's creating our reality, you know, in a way. I would say the process and the inner workings of who's creating our reality. And it might not just be as easy as saying good versus evil. Like, it's not necessarily that. So that would be part of the elevator pitch as well, would be like, there are some decisions in there that have to be made that it's like, well, for the good of humanity, we need to do this, even though the process might seem evil, you know. It's not just a clear, like, you know, dark versus light. It's mixed with some grays in there too, which is awesome. Mm-hmm. And also some esoteric and sort of occult stuff in there as well, which I love. But the characters, what was I gonna say about the that's kind of what I would think. Darren, you got any?
Well, I have the thing here.
I
wrote, but I can't really take credit for it because I used my robot to help me come up with it. So but I have it here. The world is not broken by accident. In Machiavelli Nation, Hannum presents a chilling version of a society engineered for control, where governments, corporations, and media function as interlocking mechanisms designed to extract obedience, labor, and wealth from the many for the benefit of the few. I mean, that just sounds like a description of the modern day. Mm-hmm. Bernard never sought to challenge this system. Grieving the loss of his wife and drifting through a hollowed-out existence, he is thrust into a clandestine struggle that exposes the architecture of modern power. Through a web of shadowy foundations, compromised politicians, disillusioned veterans, and self-styled cultivators, Bernard, that makes me think of influencers. Mm-hmm. Bernard discovers that revolutions are no longer fought in the streets, but in algorithms, narratives, and economic levers. As coordinated acts of disruption begin to unravel financial systems, political legitimacy, and public trust, characters on every side must confront a terrifying dilemma. If the existing order is irredeemably corrupt, what replaces it, and at what moral cost? Bold, unsettling, and unflinchingly critical, Machiavellian Nation is a meditation on power, propaganda, and the thin line between liberation and tyranny in an age where truth itself has become a battlefield. Machiavelli Nation is a provocative work of speculative fiction, political fiction, that imagines the collapse of modern power structures and the dangerous idealistic forces that rush in to replace them. Following the death of his wife, Bernard, an ordinary man burdened by grief and disillusionment, is drawn into a hidden world where elites manipulate governments, economies, and public perception with ruthless precision. Is there a Bernard?
Bam.
Is Bernard based on anyone possibly around today? Because a lot of, when you read that and you kind of go through what Graham and I have been bandying about for the last few years, at least, is that this seems to almost be what's happening real time right now for the people over in our side of the culture war. It seems like, I mean, some people would argue, say it's not. Trump is just, you know, more of the same, which you can go back and forth on. But it's hard to shelf that there's shit being talked about in 2026 that when we started this show in 2013 would have fucking been crazy, would have been absolutely bonkers. If you would have told us that this was going to be on the mainstream, you know, the aliens, the fucking this, that, all of it.
The trafficking, the Epstein. I mean, even since you started writing your book, I mean, that must be crazy that all of a sudden the Epstein thing is coming out like it was, and you've written about this whole industry in a fictional sense, the schizos and the psychos. I mean, I don't know if you've seen that go viral recently, the schizos versus the psychos, and you kind of call them the psychopaths, where, you know, that fits into your writing as well. Sorry to interrupt you there, Darren. Did you?
Done. No, there wasn't really a question. It just sort of, it makes me think of, this is where the fuck we're at in our world right now. And players, like, there's all these weird players. You got Elon, Trump, all these guys. We don't know where the fuck they're at on that. You know, what side are they on? But to your book's credit and what Graham talks about, it's hard to believe that this is that these assholes could get on for this long. And when you just seem to have this natural instinct where as a society, we sort of push back against the ruling structure that's around when we're younger. And I think you do that against your parents to a certain extent as well, especially in the more elite circles where there could be a thing where the kids or the grandkids are like, what the fuck are you guys doing, man? This is fucking crazy. Or maybe not. I mean, we are pretty malleable so that you could raise psychopaths pretty easily, I think.
Let me read something now that Darren read the description of your book. I'm going to read a post that I saved for this interview because it reminded me of your book.
Wow.
And then I'll tell you who said it, but the world as we know it is about to undergo a massive transformation. The old guard who once pulled the strings has been outmaneuvered. Once we settle all family business and tie up loose ends, the U.S. military will be consolidating the Western Hemisphere. The days of forever wars, color revolutions, proxy wars, human trafficking, drug trafficking, big pharma, bioweapon development, corrupt media, mass manipulation, unchecked crime, nuclear arms races, enslavement of the people, etc. All of it is coming to an end. Once Trump has all, now that's the, you know, that's the could be the complete psyop disinformation part. Has all the rogue assets eliminated and the global board entirely secure, we can proceed to rebuilding this world the way it was intended to be, without the tentacles of the establishment subduing us for their own nefarious agenda. We are witnessing the dawn of the golden age of humanity. So that's very Q-ish, you know, it's very...
Mm-hmm. Was that Elon that said that?
No, that was clandestine. It was a kind of a, you know, almost like a PSYOP account that sort of narrates a bit of the Q stuff. I don't think he calls it Q, but it's very much like propaganda from, let's say, the Republicans or the Trump side, you know. So I don't even want to bring it into modern day politics because, you know, you didn't really do that in your book until maybe the very end, but we can talk about that later. but that just reminded me of like kind of like the struggle between the factions, which we talk about a lot here. We're like, it seems like there's a struggle between these factions to gain some control over the world. And you got to think that some of them might not like the way things have been running for the last 50 or 80 years. And that, you know, especially since COVID and the way things are going now. And it makes you think that there's got to be some people at the top that are going like, we need to dial back the tyranny and sort of allow a more balanced sort of freedom to arrive. What do you think of that?
I haven't seen any dialing back of any tyranny. Seems like they're stepping it up at every chance they get. Have you guys heard of Professor Jiang on YouTube? I've been listening to him.
We talk about the professor all the time.
We call him Professor Op, yeah. But
yeah, I wonder if he's an op too, but... what I like about him is he doesn't seem to have any dog in the fight. You know, like he'll say, well, it's going to be the end of the world and like laugh about it, you know, or it's going to be, you know, total tyranny. But one thing, I don't know why I brought him up, but they have this thing called the technocracy, the technate, which Elon Musk's grandfather is famously a part of, where North America from Greenland to Venezuela is all one unit, a technate ruled by geniuses like Elon Musk and Bill Gates. You know, what could go wrong there? Everything's a PSYOP and there's limited hangouts galore. There's, you know, nobody's coming to save you. We have to save ourselves, and people have to understand one thing that is going to be tough to understand. There's been so much effort and expense and energy put into dividing people, dividing the left and right. And I listen to podcasters who, you know, tend to put themselves on the right, or maybe they get put into that category. And the things they say are just basically the same things that people on the left say, just in different words. You know, the people on the right are left wingers that want gun rights, and you know, basically people want to be left alone. That's what it all comes down to. And then other people want to control every aspect of your life. It makes them, you know, gives them some kind of pleasure to see other people suffer and to see themselves rise. And it's not like if everybody was rich and happy and prosperous, well, that wouldn't be good for them because they don't want to be everybody. They want someone to be way down here in the mud and broken glass and disease where they can have, you know, their Rolexes and Bentley cars and they could be happy and rich and private yachts. But if somebody's not suffering, they're still not happy with it. Yeah, I don't know where that, how I went down that path, but.
Well, yeah. Part of me thinks that it's not all engineered. There's two, that it's maybe that our modern propaganda is exaggerating to those two archetypes, you could almost say. It's like an archetype in a way. It's separating right. us out. And I don't know. I don't see how we can stay away from a more of a hot conflict that because it's not really, you know, you mentioned the TechNet, the North America TechNet. But I mean, when you look at what's happening in the West, in the UK and Canada and the EU, like I'm at the point where I don't know, man, that doesn't look like there's any way out in Canada. Like we're not getting any better and we're not and there's not a plan to get any better. I mean, this is a. And I keep repeating this, so sorry to the listeners, but I keep repeating it. But it's a controlled demolition. It's a dismantling of Canada, it seems like, you know, from everything from crime and safety. I mean, I just found out there was a couple more stabbings in our town close by, in our city close by, and like people just aren't feeling safe walking around anymore. So there's the whole like it's been taken over at every level from this. This beast that's destroying our old culture and somewhat semblance of freedom that the TechNate feels better. The TechNate feels safer and more secure, and maybe we can become more prosperous. Like that's how demoralized that archetype in Canada, which is a smaller archetype in Canada, has become. That now I'm feeling like, well, what is the only solution? What's the only thing that'll allow us to prosper and keep some freedom? So, I mean, you said that, you know, you don't see any of that coming, but you don't see any, you know, less tyranny, but in a lot of ways, there's less tyranny in the States than there is in the West. I mean, you know, Elon for all his faults and all that, X is a place where now you can discuss vaccine injuries and you can discuss people's pronouns and you can just all these things that we were getting deleted. I mean, Darren lost his account for years and years and years for something so stupid that now, you know, I don't know what the end, I mean, maybe it's just going to cause more conflict, but at least we're allowed to freely express ourselves to a certain extent.
Or incriminate ourselves.
Yeah. Or incriminate ourselves for when they put the clamp down. But
yeah, I think that's very astute, Darren, that part of it is they want you to confess, right? They want you to get on your side so that when they come and pick you up, they can say, well, look at all these tweets you liked.
Yeah.
You know?
It's almost like they flipped it open, like they pushed everybody away and then flipped it open and allowed them to come in and just, incriminate themselves.
Yeah.
Then they got you when they just changed the law. Oh, you weren't allowed to say that.
Yeah. We're retroactively going to charge you for hate speech.
Exactly.
Who's your favorite author?
Oh, wow. That's a toughie. You know, I've never learned how to pronounce his last name, but it's the author of Fight Club, Chuck Palahniuk, I think is how you say it. And I kind of channeled him a little bit in my writing, because, you know, Fight Club especially is like the all-time greatest, but just like the wild, free way that he writes with, you know, he'll talk about bodily functions in one sentence, and then, you know, very high moral concepts in the next. You know, I kind of just love that human juxtaposition of the gritty with the ideal with his writing. And I've always loved science fiction, just the idea of, like we were talking earlier about solving the problems, and, you know, you can use, you're not bound by different rules and morals and things like that. You can look at, like, every episode of Star Trek, I think, was, had an element of racism to it. But you can't be racist in the real world. You have to use the science fiction world to do that. But, you know, in a critical way, I mean. Not that they were encouraging racism or anything like that in Star Trek. But, yeah, I love the more imaginative writers and the ones that kind of break the mold, so to speak. Tolkien, George R. R. Martin.
Do you plan to follow this up? I mean, you're a writer now. It seems like this isn't like, there's a lot of shit out there, you know, a lot of crap, but this doesn't seem to fit in that camp. It's really well written. It seems like almost, I mean, when I was going through it, it makes me think movie right away. It's just written in that style that it could easily be flipped into a screenplay sort of like that. Like I say, it's right along. It's like it really makes me think of the Expanse or Game of Thrones, but in our modern ecosystem, or at least a version of it.
Yeah, I love to evoke images in people's minds. And that's kind of my writing style, is to try to tag it, a scene with something familiar, and then, you know, let the scene develop in people's minds. And a lot of the, like, most horrific things happen in the imagination. You know, but yeah, I do want to follow it up. I'm actually working on one that I think you guys would love, because it's all about, well, first it follows a younger Freddy. So it's kind of like a Freddy origin story combined with the younger Dryas impact event. And so there's a whole part of it that takes place 12,800 years ago. And, the society that lived before the flood, and it incorporates Nephilim and, you know, the handbags and all these mysterious things that people can't explain. Not the Maori. Maybe I'll figure out a way to include them as well. But it's all about the pre-flood world, but combined with our world between World War II and the present, so to speak. It's still very much in the cardboard box and post-it note phase right now, but it's going to be a sequel, but it's not just going to be like, oh, what are these people up to now? It's going to, you know, take your mind on another journey as well.
I liked how you put some solutions in this one too, you know? So you must have been thinking a lot about how to improve society or the problems, like the monetary schemes, some of the apps, some of the ideas you put in these characters and the events. I mean, do you want to talk about that maybe a little bit?
Oh, sure. So yeah, there's the way my mind works is when I don't like something, I find a way around it, like a fix for it. So like politics, we have these political parties, which they exist for their own reason. They don't exist to help people. But what if instead of that, we just had kind of a dating app for politicians where, you know, and dating means voting, okay? You're not looking to seal the deal with this person, but write their name on a ballot. But so why don't we just like have a site where people can go see where the politicians stand and how they match up with their own, you know, stances on different issues, because that's what we care about. You know, we don't care about somebody's glowing white teeth and their family and the American flag behind them. We care about, like, hey, is this person going to increase the war budget and cut my kids, you know, breakfast at their school? Or, you know, that's what we care about. So let's match up the voters and the politicians and vote for the person that we care about. You know, there's this myth in America that nobody gets elected unless they have a D or an R next to their name, you know? So that was one of the apps I came up with. I'm actually working on that. It's called Postparty. Postparty.co is the website, which will take you nowhere. Don't even go there. It's probably just going to be a GoDaddy hold thing, but I just want to make it a simple site where you can match up to your politician, vote for them, and who cares what party they belong to? These parties have done nothing but screw us over. And you guys, you know, just as bad in Canada.
Oh, worse, because they just make you vote for one party and then they just say, I'm joining the other party now. I mean, we've had six people in the last 3 months just switch parties so that now the party that didn't have total power has total power as of yesterday.
And that's the Labour, right? Or what is it called?
The Liberals.
Liberals, yeah.
We don't really have a right wing here. We have a conservative party that call it, they're kind of right wing, but really it's like a uniparty. But now the leftist party has full control of the government.
You know, it's all bull crap anyway, because they're not really left. They're authoritarian, and they just like, they're just okay with, you know, bathrooms where anyone can use the same bathroom, which really who cares? But, you know, what left really is like, there's certain things that are, that make more sense if they just come out of your taxes. You know, if your house was on fire, you wouldn't want to Google the cheapest fire department in your area and see who's available and see, you know, negotiate a price. You want the frickin' fire department to show up, put your fire out. The same thing with medicine. You don't, you know, what we have in the States, the BS propaganda makes folks in socialized medicine countries think, oh, that's the best. You get better service. No, you pay probably $80,000 a year for nothing. And then if you get sick or hurt, the insurance will hopefully cover part of that. You know, that's all it comes down to. Like, if we could just all, like, and the reason it sucks is because people are in there who make it suck. People are in the government that are stealing from it. Our post office is a classic example. They go, oh, this post office system that you have in the States, we need to make it less costly because it loses money every year. It's supposed to lose money every year. It's a service. It's supposed to lose money. That's what taxes are for. The reason everything in the government is broke is because rich people don't pay taxes. They benefit from everything that we have, from our roads that work and don't collapse on you.
You don't think the rich people pay taxes?
Well, I'm not saying they don't pay taxes, but they're it's like this. When you have the ability to make a lot of money, when you have an infrastructure, if you were to go to a wilderness somewhere and be a rich person and say, I'm going to capitalize on this wilderness. First thing you need is people, you know, and you need an idea. You need a market. You need a consumer base. You need all kinds of stuff. You don't just show up with money and it happens by magic. The reason that you can get rich and be a billionaire is because you have roads and you have electricity and you have workers that aren't, you know, trying to cure their diseases with roots and berries, which is actually probably better anyway, but they've got, you know, modern healthcare that they can use and show up on time to work and be there. No, I don't think rich people pay taxes in the way that they should. And if you look at the world at least in America, I can't speak for the rest of the world, but even in the time of Richard Nixon, who was considered like one of our most hated Republican presidents ever, the rich paid a much higher percentage of their money on taxes, and everybody benefited. When you're rich, you're affected by a kind of a disease that just makes you want more, like it's a mental disorder that just makes you want more and more. And so once you've made tons of profit and you've reduced your costs to the degree that it can, now you got to go after taxes. And so that's why these politicians can always, you know, get elected based on tax breaks. It's because they just, you know, how are you going to get more money if you've already maximized your profits and reduced your expenses? You got to reduce your taxes next. And it's just been, it's like a body that's eating itself. It's like if you started on your toes and you just kept on eating yourself. That's where we're at.
Well, I mean, we have a couple people moving down to the States to take care of their health issues. So, I mean, the socialized system's not really all what it's cracked up to be either.
If Matt, it was properly funded, it would be, though.
Yeah, that's not even funding so much. It's with but it's fucking socialism. It's sneaking socialism into this system where now there's these bureaucrats that make decisions on what's affordable and what's not, and all that's experimental. So that's all, you can't do that. And by the way, we can kill you though.
Yeah,
we could pencil you in for death this afternoon.
Yeah, that's totally effed up right there. But
I don't think you should have to pay for doctors in the richest world in the countries in the world either. You know, you really shouldn't. We have the richest, most successful fucking societies in history that we know about. You shouldn't have to pay for a doctor.
Right.
You should have to pay. You know, I don't want to go socialist, but it's kind of like you said with the fire before. You know, it's like when your house is on fire, you don't want to have to fucking try and look at reviews to figure out which fire department's the best and which one's closest to your house and which one's still open. The same thing when you break your leg. You know, you don't want to, well, your leg's broken, be going through, okay, which one of these motherfuckers is, you know, I don't know where, I mean, I don't know who has the best healthcare. Everyone's.
Well, you also need a system that has incentive to help people. I mean, I've been hearing lately that like people are just getting sent home. Like you have a disease, your neurons are not firing and we can't do anything more for you. And when you look up the stuff on the internet, there's a ton of shit you can do, but the government is so restrictive in Canada of what they can do. There's no incentive to broaden that scope because they're following whatever, you know, College of Surgeons tells you you're supposed to do in that matter. Like what, why even have a
doctor? It'd be nice if they could just give you credit. Using, like, right? Like what you're talking about, Graham, if we got credits. So that you could still have a capitalist medical system where if Graham has an idea on how to treat some sort of disease, the government doesn't have to fucking tell him it's okay for him to start that up. He can sort of start it up. A consumer can choose it. And what the government is doing is sort of doling out credits somehow. Or I don't know how that sort of works, but we need in Canada the freedom to do whatever the fuck we want with our health. And that's sort of the problem. It's like we're stuck within this system where they were going to let a kid die in Montreal that this U.S. had fucking cures for. And the fucking, luckily, that family had money, right? Because if this happens to anyone else, any of us, we're fucked. But this family, they just happened to be millionaires. So they could afford to charter a fucking medical plane from the U.S. that costs like $45,000 or something like that. Otherwise, the kid won't survive the trip down to the States. So they charter this U.S. fucking medical jet. It flies to Montreal, picks up the kid, and this isn't even experimental. Like with the kid goes down to the States, 2 months later, he's back in Canada, fully fucking cured. This is a kid that the Canadian healthcare system was going to let die in his fucking bed in Montreal. And I just don't know, you know, how do we fix it so that that we get it for free or however that works, but we still have autonomy in what we want done. It's like, hey, you don't think the naturopathy works? You think this is crazy? Fine. You're not the fucking one taking it. If you want to go get the chemo, you use your fucking service to go get the chemo from that guy that's selling the chemo. I want to go try XYZ from these people over here. And that's sort of what the States has to a certain extent that we don't have in Canada. Now, it might not be covered and you might have to pay out of pocket. But here, that's not even a fucking option. It's just like, no. And remember that case a few years ago in the UK where that kid was dying and they were like, well, there's this experimental thing in the US that we want to go try. And the fucking UK NHS said, no, you are not taking this kid out of the fucking country, period, full stop.
Wow.
So that's the problem with these socialized things is socialized medicine comes with fucking socialism, whether you like it or not. And it's not the good parts of socialism. It's the bad parts of socialism where there's a select few that are more equal than you that get to decide what your fucking fate is.
Oh.
And now we've entered the fucking era in Canada where killing you is a fucking option. And right now it's this sort of option where you decide, you know, if you want to die, we'll kill you. We keep expanding it now. Kids okay. If they're mentally ill, that's fine. Mental health. So if you're depressed, we can kill you. We can do all that sort of stuff where it's illegal to put MAID on a death certificate. So you have to put whatever the underlying condition is that caused them to have MAID. That's where we're at now, where we're killing family members of people that don't want their family members killed. And they're arguing that the family members the government is killing don't have the capacity to fucking make that decision. Now we're going to let kids do it that don't have the capacity. We've already said they don't have the capacity to make that decision until they're 18, but this is going to be okay. How long is it before guys like the three of us are like, hey man, sorry, we got to kill you. You're just fucking, you're a bad mate.
Yeah. Yeah. That's
what people are starting to look in Canada. We've now got a system where the government can kill you. Right now it's your choice. And all it takes is a fucking couple signatures and a public that's more beaten down than we are now before. Well, yeah, of course the government should have killed him. Look at all the trouble he was causing. I mean, they've already got like my in-laws saying, of course you should go to jail if you put crazy stuff on Facebook. I mean, really? This is where the news are at. Yeah, of course. You shouldn't have put that on Facebook. It's like, what the fuck are you talking about, man? Because if you expand that forward a couple generations, you can see where it's like, well, yeah, of course they should have killed him. And what the fuck? I mean, he's using up resources. We only have so many resources, and this guy is using up our resources when he's, you know, not doing A, B, and C.
And in the Machiavelli Nation aspect of this, the criminals that are actually causing physical harm are not really getting put in jail. They're just being let out and they're just causing. So there's this two-tier justice system that's happening too. So it's like, it's crazy. Your words, you're getting punished for your words more so than the physical crimes these days. I mean, it's that backwards.
Well, if you're connected, you got the right connections, then yes, yeah, you can sacrifice children all you want.
Well, in Canada, this is a problem in Canada right now. It's like if you're a fucking immigrant, you can go rape a chick. And so if Graham raped a chick and an East Indian immigrant that's only been here 6 months raped a chick, our fucking justice system has built into it that Graham is going to get in more fucking trouble because we won't prosecute people if it'll affect their immigration status. This has happened fucking dozens of times in Canada now where it's been found out that these people didn't get charged with stuff that we would, that guys like us would go to fucking jail for. And they didn't get charged with it or got like 3 months of probation with an absolute discharge at the end because they don't want to affect their refugee status.
Well, there's also the lessening the sentence because of racial oppression, which is not even about immigration, and that's
it. So I probably would get less time than you because I'm an idiot.
You'd get less time. You could, you can do it.
In the States, I don't think natives even have, you know, I don't think they're even covered by. I think they're considered a separate nation. I think the original nations here are kind of sovereign to themselves. I think there are certain guarantees of the Constitution, but
They got a way better deal than ours.
Really?
Our reserves are still owned by the government.
What is the reservation? Is
every reserve in Canada is owned by the government. Every acre.
Dang. Well, I think ours is. I don't think the government owns the reservations, but they're, you know, the borders of those reservations are whatever the government decides they're going to be, you know. But one thing you said, Darren, is you said that socialism And that's one of the things they do is label. They give us labels. They give us right wing, left wing, socialism, fascism, you know, and they tell us, well, if you have medicine that's paid for by taxes, that's socialism. And you don't want that because, you know, you'll be lined up and shot if you speak out, you know, or whatever. That's the world of Animal Farm is what socialism is. The fact is, though, there's socialism, you know, the idea of the weekend is socialist. That's something that workers fought for in the 1930s and died for. We don't get taught these lessons in school, but to label something socialism and then decide that, oh, it leads to all this oppression, it's part of the whole plan. Like when I ever hear, do you guys listen to Tinfoil Hat podcast with Sam Tripoli at all? Like, in fact, I think they're the ones that turned me on to you guys. I'm not sure. It might be the other way around. But like, oh, whenever socialism comes up, Sam like blows a gasket. He's like, oh man, can't have no socialism. But it's just what they do is try to put it in a box that says this is ugly. Don't touch anything in this box. The fact is that we can take whatever we want out of that. We can take things from communism that might work. We can take things from fascism that might work.
Which we have, right? Which we have. We live in the most socialist societies the world has ever seen in a lot of ways. And then mm-hmm. Canada and the US, right? We say we're this and that, but we have huge social safety nets in existence already. I think the problem comes in when those decisions start to be made by bureaucrats instead of the people.
Right.
Because the examples we have of trying to try these things out just tend to end up with a lot of people fucking starving to death. So it's like, I mean, I think socialism could work great. I think that there's parts of it that we do en masse. Like, you know, I don't have to worry about all this stuff because it's like we've created these societies that are pretty socialist, I would say. And to a pretty large extent, we seem to be printing money to sort of keep them going right now. But we've still created these things, especially in Canada, where really no one gets left behind. And now what I would argue is that the competency crisis that you're talking about in Machiavelli Nation is a direct result of some of these socialistic fucking tendencies. I mean, I think that there is, there's supposed to be a cost to entry that humans tend to try to eliminate with more and more. The more successful and abundant we get, we try to eliminate these cost to entry because it seems like the right thing to do, right? It does. Seems like the right thing to do. But in a way, it's sort of also the same thing that we find ourselves in where everybody gets a medal. You know, it doesn't matter if you finish first. It doesn't matter if you finish last. Everybody's going to get a medal. And now everybody trying to run our society is fucking retarded. So how much of B is because of A? How much of this goes back to these socialistic tendencies? Because what I start to look at here in the West that we see right now is like a miniature version, a little baby version of what the worst of the Soviets were going through, right? When you watch these old Soviet stuff where it's like, everyone knows that they're lying. We know they're lying. They know they're lying. What we can do is they're just lying. And not only that, it was like, you just start to put people into positions that aren't fucking up to the task, right? Like, I forget, what was it, Lorchenko or whatever it was that decided they were going to start planting seeds earlier because his fucking science said it was going to make for more resilient seeds, and they fuck up the harvest and 20 million people starve to death. Now, that's not because of evil. That's not the evils of socialism that did that. That's some fucking idiot that has no business. It relates to DEI. It relates to this situation where it's who you know, not what you know, and this sort of, but there seems to be this cancer that's going to grow. The more egalitarian we try to make these societies, how do you do that and not have the competency crisis just exasperate more and more and more and more and more? Because why should I fucking bust my ass? Why should I try harder than the next guy? Why? What are the rewards for me working 20 hours a day versus someone that works two?
Yeah, what I like to think of is this, like in the material realm, there should be a floor. So like, let's say you're the laziest person in the world and you just don't care about anything that the mainstream society cares about. And you don't want to work for someone else. You know, you're, if you think about it, working for someone else, you're selling your time, you're selling your life.
Totally. But you also have to look at that as like a betterment. Some of that has to, you also have to factor in like personal growth and advancement. And because what I always like to say is the American dream was never supposed to be everybody gets rich. Right. The American dream was supposed to be that fucking it's better for my kids than it was for me. And it's better for my grandkids than it was for my kids and so on and so forth. And that seems to be the thing that I don't know where we lost it, but we lost it. You know, like now it's like the boomers are keeping all their money and it's got not, you know, it's like spend the inheritance. And I'm not even saying that we should be getting inheritance, but there used to be this ingrowing thing back in the early 1800s and stuff that it wasn't about you. It was about fucking improving and improving and improving so that your great, great, great grandkids would live in a better version of it than you're living it. And now it seems to be just sort of mixed in with this selfishness where it's fucking, you know, families that barely see each other anymore. There's no sort of, you know, I mean, some of them are. The rich ones seem to be better at it than we are in a lot of ways. We seem to have just dissolved the nuclear families to the point where all that's sort of gone away and it's every man for himself, whereas it used to be less about is like, sure, I had to go, I get to be where I am today because my fucking grandpa went and worked at that factory every day and fucking went there every day and made the money and saved it. And he made it so that my mom could have a better fucking life. And then I can have this life where I'm able to do all these things that fucking weren't even really possible to him just because of the nature of the beast, right? When you're in a small town in Canada in the 1940s, what are you going to do? You know, you don't have the internet. You can only do so much with where you are. So I think that part of it sort of gets mixed up in that. I don't know if there's a question there or not, but I do think that this sort of the people, it's like we want everything now. There's this sort of built-in thing where it's not, where your kids having a better life isn't good enough anymore. I want my better life right now.
Well said. Yeah, I think labeling is a big problem right now. Just putting labels on things and people and trying to put them into a category. And as far as what you're saying about being Canada being captured, that's a large degree to the due to the political parties. I think you could really use this post-party system there as well, because there's the vast majority of Canadians don't live in the cities. Isn't that right? Or am I wrong there?
No, it's mostly in the cities.
So it's mostly people in the cities, and then you have small populations in the towns.
Yeah, I don't think it's quite as big as yours, but it's got to be, I'm guessing, 70 or 80%.
But then maybe 90% of the landmass is people that are living in small communities, right?
Yep.
Yeah, there needs to be, what's good for the city is not good for the country. You know, everybody knows that. So there needs to be different rules for different regions. But I think you're 100% right that people are put into these positions of power without the skills or knowledge that they need. Because they fit a brand, because the political party can run them. They look a certain way, they talk a certain way, they have, you know, certain grandparents or parents in the case of Trudeau, and they fit this brand and they get put in there because of the way the political parties are. And yeah, it's, you know, you said it was more egalitarian, but it's actually, in a sense, more authoritarian, because they're telling you, no, you must, you know, say these words this way. You can't think on your own. You know, this person is a woman because he told me that he was, you know, and you have to use their pronouns, even though they just made them up today. You know, you just have to use them or you're going to jail. Like, that's insanity. That's not, It's got nothing to do with the left or socialism or communism. That's like massively overstepping the bounds of control by the government. And that's wrong no matter who's doing it. You know, even if it's like the a new system called maximum freedom and they're like making you do crazy stuff or go to jail, that's where we're at now. Is you might have the Republicans on our side of the border who are the right-wing party saying the same things that your liberals on your side of the border are saying. And it's all got to do with do what we say. Don't talk back. Don't think for yourself. Fit in your role that we gave you and just do it. And just, you know, be productive and be quiet and eat the bugs.
That's a good point, because the Overton window has shifted too, right? So now the left is really like the left you're talking about is more of the right. And now the left that is today is just farther left as well than it used to be. Like, but they're kind of just, you know, lumped in with the left, and anything that's not left is just lumped in with the right. You know, sorry, I locked the cats out and he broke in. He broke in somehow. It's like, so I do wonder just what do you think, especially after researching this and doing the book? And I mean, I know you kind of express it in the book, but how do you think the power structure is at the very top? Like, do you think this is all like, you know, there's a secret cabal of people that are kind of pulling the strings and pushing the agenda along? Like, what's your thought of the overall sort of power structure?
Yeah, 100%. I think there's gangs that exist and they use the levers of power that we have. I think that, and I think the introduction in the book says this pretty well. We have a constitution in our country that it doesn't give people rights, but it puts it out there in black and white. Hey, you people have rights. You know, you are supposed to be free people until you either step on someone else's toes or do something that's not going to, you know, that's going to cause damage somewhere along the lines. But up until that point, you're free. In exchange for this freedom, we're supposed to, you know, help the society along, fight the wars and that kind of thing. But over the years, it's just, they've just been, the powers have been just chiseling away at those freedoms and rights. And I think that there's some shadowy characters whose names we may never know that push these agendas of theirs. And I think everything that we think of as culture and events that happen, 99% of it is pushed out by these powers. I think 9/11 was part of that. I think COVID was part of that. I think World War I, World War II were part of that. And as far as who it is, doesn't really matter. The important thing is that we have these constitutions, and the constitutions say that the people are sovereign, and they say that you should abolish any government that says otherwise. And it's the time of the people now to create this alternative, you know, structure that's sustainable, because this is not sustainable. This idea that people are going to vacuum up, you know, silos of cash and just sit on them so they can brag about how much, you know, how high they are on the Forbes list or whatever, while people are starving and sleeping in the streets, you know, that's not sustainable. And yeah, it's time for different structures. And it kind of goes back to the question you asked about the websites. We have to organize, and, you know, the websites are the way to do that.
Well, like your your character said, and I love the dialogue where they're trying to get the people to revolt, and they're like, we tried all these things, they're not revolting, false flags, all these things, we can't get the people to revolt. Because that's something we've talked about as well. It's like, do they want us to, it's like they want us to revolt.
But I've often thought that they're wanting it. Like, they're going to push and push and push, and it's like, but then we, you know, never do. And they're like, well, we got away with that one. Like when the one guy jacked up the price of insulin from $7 a vial to like $140 a vial, and nobody did anything. That guy's head should be, you know, I don't know who that was. This is not, I'm not saying that we should attack anybody or harm anyone, but, you know, by the laws of justice, there should be a pike that should not be empty somewhere. I'll just leave it at that. But yeah, it's a miracle that we haven't revolted, and sometimes it does seem that way, like they're pushing us to it.
Does start to seem that way. Hanum, this has been a great chat. It's flying by. The book is fantastic. Where's the best place for people to get it? Of course, they can go to adultbrain.ca, and there's links for it to get it on print, ebook, and the audiobook all from there. It's on Amazon. What about signed copies? Are you doing anything like that?
I don't have anything in place to do signed copies, but if anybody wants a signed copy, I haven't thought about that. But the best place for the audiobook is definitely adultbrain.ca. You can get it on Amazon. They charge more. And if we can put a direct link in the notes for the Ingram site so they can buy it directly from Ingram, that's great too. Yeah, stopped using Amazon.
If they go to Adult Brain, the ebook and the hard book and the paperback link will go right to your Ingram account.
Oh, perfect.
So that's
Go to adultbrain.ca. And part of the reason I wanted to publish, before I go there, like, it's been such a pleasure working with the two of you publishing the book. If anybody is thinking about publishing a book, especially something that's kind of off the mainstream like mine, I highly recommend Adult Brain. They've been great to work with.
Oh, thanks, buddy.
Yeah, and nothing but 4 stars all the way, or 5 stars, however many stars we can get.
Thanks, buddy. And I mean, honestly, if people are interested, if they have extra Audible credits, go out and get this book on Audible, get a credit, maybe get some virality happening, listen to it, review it, all that stuff.
Thanks. Yeah, and I do the reading on it.
Yeah. Yeah, you do a good job. I wish there was a part two.
I did find a couple of your things where you're cussing. It reminded me of Graham back in the day. When you try a sentence 3 times in a row.
Well, I hope you got rid of those. But hey, it's an Easter egg if not.
I actually missed one. I missed one, and one of the proof listeners sent it to me. He's like, there's a fuck in here, and I'm not sure if it's supposed to be or not.
I wish there was a part two. I really do.
Yeah, well, it's coming.
All of our proof listeners loved it. That's like, usually it's a slog for them, but all three of them said they thoroughly enjoyed it.
Well, thank you to them, and I'll send them a signed copy of the audio book whenever they want.
Beauty. Yeah, they listen to the audio book. So you did a great job. It's not easy reading an audio book. It really starts to come together. Part two will be good because there's certain things that you can only get better at by doing them.
Thanks. Yeah. Well, it's been great. And thank you to you, both of you guys. And your show has been an inspiration to me for a long time as well.
Thanks.
I know cloning is real, by the way, because all the stuff you guys do, you must have at least 2 clones of yourselves to get all that stuff done.
It'd be nice. The clone will be trouble after a while, though. You can just see it's a matter of time before he starts wanting your shit. Adam, this has been fantastic. We appreciate you coming on the show. We appreciate you working with us on the book. We encourage everybody to go out and get Machiavelli Nation. Use those Audible credits. You can get it on ebook, hardback, whatever format you want. Thank you for coming on the show. Come back anytime.
Thank you very much. You guys, it's been a blast.
All right. Have a good rest of your day, sir. And that was a chat with Hannah, Machiavelli Nation. What'd you think? I mean, I knew you were going to like that book. I knew you were going to get fucking roped right into it.
Oh, yeah, totally. Yeah, it was great.
You know what? I'm going to go through the whole thing from start to finish again next week. We got like 55 hours or 60 hours on airplanes. So perfect time to just go through the whole like 13 and a half hours in one sort of sitting. That'll give me time to, I'm just finishing up The Expanse again now. But I think I'll do Machiavelli Nation on the way down to Chile. And on the way back, I might try that other one we were talking about. I forget what it was called again already. The Hail Mary, Project Hail Mary. Try that shit out. I watched a movie last night where the moon was getting closer to Earth. I was going to crash into Earth because of an alien.
What's it called? I think moon, I remember that one. Came out maybe 5-6 years ago or something like that.
Yeah, that sounds about right. It was like Moonshot or Moonland or Moon something. I didn't make it. I fell asleep. It was
I just watched Prometheus. I think you were talking about it recently, weren't you? Or?
Yeah, I rewatched Prometheus.
Yeah, it was good. Yeah.
Because, you know, when that came out was the very beginning of the show. I think episode 2, like at the beginning, has the little line from the show where it's like big things of small beginnings or something like that.
Oh, wow. I didn't know it was that old.
Yeah. So that would have been 2013. Yeah. Right around there. 2012. I watched it again, too. It was kind of shitty, honestly, the second time around. But it's good and crappy, you know?
What do you mean shitty? Why? How?
I don't know. I remembered it being better.
Yeah.
I remembered it being like more esoteric, I guess, and less prequel.
It was kind of more of like violent and all the deaths and stuff. It's hard to believe that. Yeah.
Yeah. But it was still good. I mean, it could have used a sequel, I guess. Because what happens at the end? Doesn't she get off the ship or she blows it up? I forget. Spoiler alert. I mean, it's hard to find a good movie these days. It really is. What else did I just... I watched a Mad Max one. That was fucking maybe the worst movie I've ever seen. Like on the list for just over the top in every direction. The new Mad Max.
I watched Annihilation. You'd like it. You'd like it.
Would I? Was it good?
The book was supposed to be really good.
Yeah. The book?
Yeah.
Interesting. I'm stacking up some credits again. So maybe I'll pop that in. Summer is a good time because I do a lot more driving in summer. So that's when it's in fall when I'm heading out to hunting and back. Like just in the last fucking week of hunting, I probably get in a whole book and a half, you know?
Yeah.
But we'll get into that more on the intro for the next show. My most successful snow goose hunt. Finally, after years of effort, we fucking hammered him. But big thanks to Hannah for coming on the show. Big thanks to Hannah for using us to produce this book. I mean, when it becomes a movie and it's a bestseller and all that stuff, it's going to be great to have been a part of.
Yep.
So we wish him well. Check out GrandAmericaOutlaw.ca for other podcasts. Contact at thecabin.com for trips and events. AdultBrain.ca. You can find Machiavelli Nation there and all the other books we've done. AmericaCBD.com, DisasterMap.ca. It's all out there, all in the show notes. Other than that, we love you guys. Thanks for listening, and we will see you next week.
5 pink flamingos and a few flamenco dancers. They're in the kitchen and they're baking Day of the Dead cookies. And I step into the kitchen and I'm like, let me have a looky, see what kind of cookie you're cooking up. And they're looking up at me, skeptical. And I Poindex to my spectacles. And I'm wearing a maroon Harvard t-shirt. Yeah, I know I'm a smart cookie, but I'm no psychic. You can come and ring my bell. But where we're gonna end up in the future, I can never tell. I can never tell. Best friends and a few few of my enemies. We're at the coffee shop and we're settling our differences. Benjamin Otto pulls out a game of Chinese checkers and he orders a cappuccino. And I pick blue and he picks red and you pick yellow. And I'm wearing a tie-dye peace sign t-shirt. Yeah, I know I'm a peacenik, but I ain't no hypocrite. You can come and ring my bell, but where we're gonna end up in the future, I can never tell. I can never tell. One bell, one man, and with my sense of smell, I can smell the salt in your tears. I can sense your fears. You're hoping for a bit of divinity in this worldly vicinity. And you understand the fragility of the human vessel. And you sit Indian style like a pretzel. And you levitate to a transcendental state when you meditate. And you levitate to a transcendental state when you meditate. And you levitate to a transcendental state when you meditate.